Time now to begin the reading of the Boston Herald for the 20th of August, 2026. You are listening to the Talking Information Center. With today's reading of the Boston Herald, we say hello to Doug and Herb.
Oh, the test is going.
And here's Doug and Herb with today's reading of the Boston Herald.
Okay, Herb, you're on.
Hello again. Welcome. The headlines: Wu wins. State judicial SIC sides with city on $325 million white stadium. The mayor's risky power play. Got to read Battenfeld to find out. And also, bad days, worse days. Lindsay Clancy, in the depths of despair. Clancy has bad days and worse days, but is not criminally responsible, the doctor testifies, by Colleen Cronin. A forensic psychologist testified that Lindsay Clancy was suffering from a mental disease or defect when she killed her three children and is not criminally responsible for their deaths. She had no appreciation for the wrongfulness of her act, Dr. Paul Ziesel said on the stand yesterday in Clancy's triple murder trial. Clancy doesn't dispute that she strangled her children. Cora 5, Dawson 3, and Callan, 8 months, on June 24th, 2023, before trying to kill herself, leaving her paralyzed. Instead, her attorney, Kevin Reddington, has argued that Clancy was suffering from postpartum psychosis at the time, a diagnosis for Clancy along with bipolar disorder that Ziesel described on the stand. Ziesel said he made his determination by looking at Clancy's medical records, interviewing third parties like family and people who knew Clancy, as well as sitting down with the defendant dozens of times. He went through her medical history in the fall of 2022 and in January 2023, describing the persistent, intrusive thoughts she experienced the last month the children were alive. She wasn't just having everyday thoughts that we all have, intrusive thoughts. Are unrelenting. They don't stop, Ziesel said. They were getting worse and telling her to kill herself. He categorized what had been cataloged as intrusive thoughts by Clancy at the time as repeated auditory hallucinations, voices that she didn't think were hers, but didn't determine their origin. Ziesel mentioned her Googling questions about whether sociopaths can be treated, as well as what the symptoms of hallucinations and psychosis are, days before the killings. Ziesel also noted that the psychological test, he found that Clancy didn't have any type of antisocial disease or sociopathy. On cross-examination, when he asked about the activities that Clancy was able to complete the day that she killed her children, driving, going to the doctor, directing her then-husband to pick up medicine for Cora, Ziesel explained that someone in the midst of a psychosis might have trouble doing new tasks, but would be able to do things that were a part of their everyday. Psychosis doesn't lower your ability to do those things, Ziesel said. Plymouth Assistant District Attorney Shannon Buckingham also asked whether masking psychosis would have a lot of control. The psychologist testified that That would depend on how loud the auditory hallucination sounded to the individual. She questioned how Zeisel came to the conclusion that Clancy had heard voices in the lead-up to the night and the night of the killings. Where in the records did she tell any of the providers she saw, that she heard, and a voice is telling her to kill herself, Buckingham asked. It was not in the records, Ziegel said. Buckingham also asked if she heard voices since. She has not heard any voices since the event took place, Ziegel said. Prosecutor also spent a lot of time asking Ziegel about his impartiality in the case. Objectivity is a tenet of forensic psychology, Ziegel agreed, saying that for reasons you cannot be a therapist and an examiner. Buckingham then pointed to a court filing about Clancy's accommodations during the trial, where Ziegel called Clancy his patient. If I examined her, she's my patient, he said. Ziegel said he'd seen Clancy about 60 times since first meeting her in February of 2023, including 20 visits to her since the trial started. He said that this helped him make a more informed opinion of Clancy's mental state and lack of criminal responsibility. But Buckingham asked whether that number of visits was typical. It does happen, but it's not typical, Ziegel answered. Buckingham also asked Ziegel about records from Tewksbury Hospital, where Clancy had been getting treatment while awaiting trial. She read out notes on Clancy's behavior on Calnan, Dawson, and Cora's birthdays, as well as the anniversary of the killings. On those days, Clancy was observed accepting medications, sometimes socializing with select patients, engaging with staff, hanging out in the TV room, and getting a visit from her parents, who would bring dinner. On redirect, Reddington also asked whether those activities were indicative of her mental state, and Ziegel said no. Although Clancy has not attempted to kill herself since the night of the killings, she does have suicidal ideation and is always accompanied by a staff member to ensure that she doesn't follow through with these thoughts at Tewksbury Hospital, Ziegel said. Lindsay Clancy has bad days and worse days, he said. Ziegel also said he has been seeing Clancy in lockup during the trial to determine her stability and whether she is still competent to stand trial. You got into this case out of compassion, Redding said, asked Ziegel, and the psychologist said yes. Reddington also asked if the doctor cared about Clancy. I do, he said. Is that a violation of ethics? Reddington followed up. Ziegel said no, telling the jury that it could be seen as an asset. Within the ethical standard, it may be appropriate and meaningful during a forensic evaluation to develop empathy. Doug?
Here's another front page article by Gaylor Cowley. SJC boots White Stadium lawsuit. $325 million soccer deal ago. The state Supreme Judicial Court handed Mayor Michelle Wu a win, ruling against a lawsuit challenging the legality of Boston's public-private plan to rehab White Stadium for a pro soccer team, thus ending the community's last chance to kill the $325 million project. The SJC upheld a Suffolk Superior Court ruling in favor of the City of Boston and Boston Legacy FC, finding that the proposed professional soccer use of the stadium would not illegally privatize public parkland, as asserted by the plaintiffs, a group of park neighbors in the Emerald Necklace Conservancy. Today's clear and unanimous decision from the state's highest court confirms that Boston's student athletes, park lovers, and community will fully benefit from this landmark investment in our future without further delay, Wu said in a statement. Renovations at White Stadium and Franklin Park are well underway to deliver a state-of-the-art facility that will be available in every season, open every day of the year, and create opportunities for unprecedented public benefit. This is a great victory for our city and for all who believe that Boston can and should take big swings to get things done for our community, Wu added. Jennifer Epstein, controlling owner of Boston Legacy, the city's private partner, called the SJC ruling a tremendous victory for Boston Public Schools students and Franklin Park community and the future of professional women's soccer in Boston. The lawsuit alleged the proposed professional soccer use of the stadium would illegally privatize public parkland in violation of Article 97 of the state constitution, and therefore required review by the legislature for a change in use. The city disputed the privatization claim, saying the city and Boston Public Schools will maintain ownership of the stadium under a 10-year lease agreement with Boston Legacy. A Suffolk Superior Court judge sided with the city after a 3-day trial last year, leading the plaintiffs to appeal the ruling. The Supreme Judicial Court took up the case and ruled on the lawsuit after hearing arguments from both sides during an hour-long hearing in April. The SJC ruled that while the stadium parcel was once dedicated for use as a public park, as argued by the plaintiffs, its allowed use changed long ago, and the city and soccer team can produce with the stadium rebuilt without legislative review. To the main issue in this appeal, we conclude that, although the stadium parcel was originally acquired by the City of Boston by eminent domain for use as a public park as a result of legislative action in 1947 and 1950, the stadium parcel was thereafter dedicated to another use not subject to the provisions of Article 97, the SJC wrote. More specifically, In 1947, the legislature authorized the stadium parcel to be conveyed at fair market value to the White Fund to be used in accordance with the purposes identified in Article 14 of the will of George Robert White, and those purposes were not limited to park use. And in 1950, the legislature recognized and designed White Stadium and the stadium parcel as a school building and yard to be repaired and maintained as such through appropriation by the city school committee, the SJC added. The SJC said that, taken together, these two pieces of legislation effectively removed the stadium parcel from its previous designation as parkland and made it a school department facility to be maintained by the school committee. Accordingly, by the time Article 97 was ratified, over 20 years later, in 1972, the stadium parcel was no longer subject to its provisions, the SJC wrote. The lawsuit highlighted how divisive the White Stadium project has been in Boston. Parking and traffic concerns have been raised by Franklin Park neighbors since the $325 million public-private plan to rebuild White Stadium for shared use by the Legacy in Boston Public Schools student athletes was announced 2 years ago. Other concerns have centered around the escalating price tag. Taxpayers are on the hook for the city's half of the costs, which have nearly tripled from $50 million initially to $135 million earlier this year. We are disappointed by this outcome, which means that a new professional for-profit sports stadium and entertainment complex in Franklin Park will not be subject to the high level of scrutiny, formal review of alternatives, and required approvals that our state's constitutional public recreation land protection laws require, Emerald Necklace Conservancy President Karen Mauney Brodeck said in a statement. We do not think the current proposal is the right one for the park or the communities that surround it. There is still time to transition to a smaller but fully public project that would be better for Boston students, the public, and local residents, Marty Broderick said. Opponents of the public-private deal have pitched a high school-only stadium alternative that they say can be built at a fraction of the cost to taxpayers, $64.6 million. Such a project would be much more affordable, would not displace previous users of the playing field, like the BPS football program, would not negatively impact existing park users and neighbors, and from a maintenance perspective, would be significantly more sustainable long-term, Marty Broderick said. Wu administration officials have said that a public-only rebuild would cost well over $135 million, the latest projected cost to taxpayers, and have defended the stadium plan, saying that the city could not afford to rebuild the long-dilapidated facility without a private investment partner. The Legacy, a national women's soccer league team that played in its inaugural season at Foxborough's Gillette Stadium this year due to White Stadium construction and litigation delays, is paying more than $190 million for its half of the rebuild.
Herb? New election chief in time for primary, Gayla Cowrey writes, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has hired a new leader of the election department, head of the state primary, as the city continues to make changes to try to work itself out of state receivership after a disastrous election 2 years ago. Wu announced City Hall veteran Kerry Jordan yesterday as the new executive director of the Boston Election Department. Kerry is the son of a Dorchester Public Schools alum and a dedicated public servant who knows that the right tech tools can help close gaps between the city and our communities, Dew said at a City Hall press conference. I can't think of a better person to lead our city's elections and elections department. Jordan works as chief of staff for the city's Department of Innovation and Technology and will move into his new position after the primary on September 8th. He was paid $146,264 by the city last year, and it's unclear whether his new job comes with a pay bump, as Wu's office could not immediately provide salary details. The former elections commissioner, seemingly the position Jordan is replacing, was paid $146,416. The job posting listed in city's salary for a cost of $145,000. Wu said Jordan has worked for the city for 18 years. Jordan added he's spent the past 5 years in the Department of Innovation and Technology. Jordan said he's excited to lead the election department and help ensure that the city meets this common goal, which is to hold fair, secure, and accessible elections. He replaces Anita Tavares, the city election commissioner since 2019, who bounced to a different city department earlier this year after overseeing a chaotic 2024 presidential election that led to the city's election department being placed in state receivership for, quote, incompetence, as Secretary of State William Gabbin put it. City officials said that they have made a number of changes aimed at ensuring a smooth primary election on September 1st. Galvin's office said Boston's performance this election season will determine whether state oversight continues. In the order that the secretary issued after the 2024 election, stated that the receivership would be in place through the 2026 state election and would be reassessed after that election. Goblin spokesman Deborah O'Malley said. Paul Chong, the city's registrar and commissioner of public records, would not speculate on whether efforts to improve election effectiveness in Boston would lead to an end to state receivership after the November 3rd general election. I expect that we will have that conversation on the heels of a very successful election, Chong said. We're working closely with our partners in the state government and Secretary Galvin's office. We are very confident that we are going to have safe, free, and fair elections. Chong said the city has made changes to modernize city elections, such as last year's expansion of electronic poll books that reduced check-in times for voters, allowed for real-time ballot tracking, and the ability and to quickly redirect a voter who showed up at the wrong polling site. Galvin placed the city's election department in receivership in February of 2025 for its failure to properly administer the 2024 state and presidential elections, which he said reflected, quote, incompetence on the part of the city. Widespread ballot shortages in that fall election left voters waiting in lines for hours to vote. Galvin's office on Election Day 2024 had to issue a directive to Boston police to rush ballots to multiple polling stations so residents could vote, as Galvin said city staff wouldn't answer the phone on the election in the elections department. Chong said the city is confident we're going to have plenty of ballots this time around for the state primary and general elections, while again citing the electronic poll books and updating procedures that will allow election officials to better track the ballot inventory and potential shortages at polling stations. Who said the city technology changes led to successful elections last year, while emphasizing that the challenges that we saw in the last presidential election were 2 years ago. Last year was a really important opportunity for us to work hard in hand with the Secretary of State's office to implement and test out this new technology, Wu said. As far as we could tell, the last election cycle in 2025 went very successfully. The city will also be under federal oversight this election season. The Department of Justice is sending election monitors to Boston for the September 1st primary. Chong said the Fed will be in town to monitor the election department, not the voters, who should not be put off from casting their ballots. Quote, we feel that we are prepared for whatever comes to see what we do and how we do elections in Boston, Chong said. I want to emphasize for voters, especially, that election monitors are here to observe. If they come in, the election department, not voters. And so I strongly encourage voters to participate in our election this coming September. Doug?
Here's an AP article. Safety was an afterthought. Former Meta engineer testifies in social media dangers trial. A former engineering director at Meta, who has testified before Congress about child safety on Instagram, told jurors Wednesday at a landmark trial that the company took a, quote, don't ask, don't tell approach on kids under 13 on its platforms. During his second day of testimony, Arturo Bejar said Meta consistently prioritized profits over safety in designing its products, focusing on how often and for how long people use them, even if it was detrimental to their mental well-being. If you step away from the product, they are not going to make any money, he said. The trial that began Tuesday in federal court in Oakland, California, pits Meta against the states of California, Colorado, Kentucky, and New Jersey, and is expected to last about 6 weeks. The four states were among 29 that sued the tech giant in 2023 over child safety and privacy. The other 25 will go on trial or go to trial later. The company also faces lawsuits in state courts, including one filed in Massachusetts and another underway in Tennessee. The lawsuit accuses Meta of contributing to the youth mental health crisis by knowingly and deliberately designing features that addict children to its platforms and hide these harms from the public. The attitude in particular on Instagram was, "Don't ask, don't tell," Bejar said in a response to a question about his perception of the company's attitude towards users under 13. The company has rejected the claims and said evidence at the trial will show its commitment to safety. You will hear over the course of the case, this case, a lot of important issues. Issues like teen mental health, issues like social media, issues like how teens use social media, Meta lawyer Paul Schmidt said Tuesday. Those issues, important issues, and they're issues where Meta believes that it has a responsibility. It has a responsibility to act on its own. It has a responsibility to try to work with teens and parents in partnership to try to address those questions. Bejar worked at Facebook from 2009 to 2015, attracting wide attention for her work to combat cyberbullying. He returned from 2019 to 2021 as a contractor to work on safety issues. He testified before Congress in 2023 about social media and the teen mental health crisis, saying that Meta executives, including CEO Mark Zuckerberg, knew about harms Instagram was causing, but chose not to make meaningful changes to address them. In his testimony Wednesday, Bejar said employee performance reviews and compensation for those who worked on user-facing products were mostly focused on user numbers and how long they spend with those products. In that context, safety was an afterthought, he said. The states are seeking changes to user experience for Facebook and Instagram, as well as financial damages, which could include billions of dollars in penalties. This case is about stopping Meta from offering dangerous product to teens and from lying to teens, families, and the public about the dangerousness of their platforms. The primary remedy under our state consumer protection law is an injunction, the statement said. Bejar walked through Meta features he said were designed for adults and are inherently unsafe for teenagers. This includes video autoplay, which can mean teens see videos that may cause them harm even if they don't click on them, as well as various counters that track how many people liked, viewed, or commented on your content, or how many followers you have. Child development experts have noted teenagers are more susceptible to social comparison than adults. So products that reward popularity can be more harmful for their mental health. Meta says users must be at least 13 years old to create an account in line with federal child privacy laws. But Bejar testified that he found tens of thousands of kids under 13 on Instagram through research. His research. He said it was common knowledge at the company that such young children were on Instagram. Herb?
Article titled Harvard's $53 million body parts payout. Todd Pressman and Grace Zokovich. Harvard Medical School will pay $53 million in payout to settle the, quote, despicable, abhorrent body parts scandal that shocked the university and resulted in a string of convictions on charges related to the gruesome sale of human remains from the academic morgue. Class action settlement was preliminarily approved in Suffolk Superior Court during a Tuesday afternoon hearing after university officials announced the proposed resolution in a public letter the day before. Quote, a third-party settlement administrator will be appointed to, among other things, notify potential class members, including by creating a website with information on eligibility and instructions for submitting a claim, and to distribute settlement funds, said George Q. Quigley, George Q. Daly, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, and Bernard S. Chang, Dean for Medical Education, in a joint letter to the medical school community. This process, from beginning to end, is expected to take several months. In line with the class action settlement, Harvard will establish two class action settlement funds totaling $53 million to resolve the lawsuits. The court found the settlement fair, just, reasonable, and adequate to the certified class and its members. Suffolk Superior Judge Deborah Squires Lee stated in her decision Tuesday, a final court approval hearing is scheduled for December. The lawsuit follows a gruesome scheme between 2018 and 2022, in which former Harvard morgue manager Cedric Lodge, 58, facilitated the trade of human body parts donated to the medical research facility, along with his wife and buyer parties. Lodge was convicted of interstate transport of stolen human remains and sentenced to, in December, to 96 months in prison. Federal prosecutors in the indictment against Lodge noted that the body parts traded he coordinated occurred without the knowledge or permission of HMS. Additionally, seven other co-conspirators have been convicted of crimes related to the macabre Marquette, including a Haverhill woman who was sentenced in federal court in Pennsylvania to 2 years in jail earlier this week. The morgue manager's wife, Denise Lodge, was sentenced to a year and a day. 47 relatives of the people whose remains were potentially mishandled filed lawsuits against president and fellows of Harvard College Medical School Anatomical Gifts Program, Director Mark Cicchetti, and AGP Manager Tracy Fay in 2023. The lawsuits were dismissed in Superior Court on the grounds that the defendants were entitled to a good faith defense under the Uniform Anatomical Gifts Act. The dismissal of cases against Harvard and Clichetti was later reversed in the Supreme Judicial Court, which ruled that plaintiffs established, quote, peculiarly pervasive noncompliance with the requirements of the Act, including a failure to ensure the dignified treatment of and the disposition of anatomical gifts. Harvard worked cooperatively toward resolution of the litigation, said Ketch's law attorney for the plaintiffs, Jonathan Sweet, following a Tuesday statement. Fellow Ketch's law attorney, Jeffrey Catalano, said the cases were always about more than financial compensation. Quote, it was about the dignity, trust, and ensuring that families who make the extraordinary decision to donate a loved one's body to medical science can be confident that their loved ones will be treated with respect, said Catalano. The precedent established through this litigation will help protect families and donated remains at medical schools and institutions throughout Massachusetts. Harvard leadership, and despite the conclusion in the criminal and civil cases, the process of recovering from this painful incident continues. The settlement also includes requirement for Harvard Medical School to hold a live webinar with families to further condemn the treatment of the anatomical donors and provide updates on improvements within the anatomical gift program. The school implemented commissioned recommendations to update the AGP in 2023 related to, quote, governance, policies, communications, specimens, collections, and facilities. Dalian Chang also noted a new annual financial and scholarship for medical students in appreciation and in honor of all anatomical donors, beginning with the 27-28 school year. These events do not reflect the reverence we hold for the altruistic individuals who selflessly donate their bodies to our anatomical gift program to provide essential educational opportunities in medical and dental students, practicing surgeons, and allied health professionals. Dalian Chang wrote in a letter to the community, "We affirm our deep sorrow and empathy for the families of donors who may have been impacted." Doug?
Here's Joe Battenfeld's column today. Wu ICE warning smacks of abuse. Michelle Wu's ominous warnings to Boston parking lot owners who do business with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement smacks of extortions and represents a dramatic abuse of her mayoral powers. So what is the power-hungry Wu going to do exactly to owners of private parking facilities who lease spaces to President Donald Trump's ICE so-called surge parking? How will the mayor of Boston weaponize city government to punish them for their defiance? Send inspectors to scour their garages and lots for code violations? ICE is seeking 249 contiguous spaces in Boston per a notice the agency posted this month on a government procurement site. That's a lot of parking. Will she harass the owners of the parking lots targeting their rental properties or businesses? Audit their taxes? Review their licenses? There's no telling how far the mayor will go to get her way. It could get ugly. "I asked you to join us," Wu wrote in her letter to parking garage and lot owners. "Reject any proposed proposition by ICE to facilitate an attack on the people of Boston." That doesn't sound like asking. It sounds like harassment, intimidation, bullying. Call it what you will, but it's wrong and dangerous. If this heavy-handed abuse of government authority is allowed to stand, there will be no stopping the queen of Wutopia. The parking lot owners may bow when she enters the GBH studio for her grueling interviews, but must we all humiliate ourselves in the same way? Don't expect the spineless city council to call her out, or the woke media, or the attorney general's Dartmouth branch office. Once Wu's staff figures out how the FOIA law works, which she obviously doesn't know, given she is the least transparent administration in city history and routinely ignores FOIA requests, they will go about the nasty business of exposing which parking owners let ICE in. Then the extremist anti-ICE protesters can block the entrance and the exits, not to mention graffiti, vandalism, threats, and other efforts to disrupt their businesses that contribute to the city economy. All this and more in the safest city in America. The parking facility owners who wind up on Wu's blacklist need to take this to two places, the courts and the U.S. attorney. Because if they bow down, who knows what's next? ICE and the Department of Homeland Security at least aren't backing down from Wu's harassment. Pro-criminal Mayor Wu knows she has zero authority to block ICE from utilizing private property. So she's just trying to intimidate Bostonians, DHS wrote. If private citizens want to allow federal law enforcement onto their own property, they should be allowed to do so. They should not face threats from their radical mayor, who shamelessly compared ICE agents to the neo-Nazi group, DHS added. DHS posted again on X Tuesday, calling Wu's actions unhinged. Herb?
Peter Lucas's opinion piece today is titled Velis, V-E-L-I-S. Velis is a voice of reason among the Massachusetts Democrats. He may not be the John Fetterman of Massachusetts, but he sure sounds like it. He is State Senator John Velis, 45, of Westfield, who recently returned from deployment with the National Guard at the U.S. southern border. So when it comes to opening the country's borders, along with other radical proposals of the Democratic Socialists of America, like ending deportation of criminal illegal immigrants, Velis knows what he's talking about. Removing all safeguards at the border, we would have dire and catastrophic consequences. There are people in this world who seek to harm this country and its people, Velis said. Anyone who fails to acknowledge that, like the DSA, should not be taken seriously. Prior to the border deployment, Velis served in Afghanistan, where he reached the rank of major and was awarded the Bronze Star. He was also deployed to South Korea to conduct training operations. But the border is only one issue that Velis, a traditional Democrat, is taking on the DSA in a state where leading Democrats have either embraced the hijacking of their party by the radical DSA or have run for cover. As such, Velis has become a lone anti-DSA voice in the wilderness of Massachusetts. Fetterman, of course, is the moderate, liberal, Democratic U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, who almost single-handedly is taking on the socialists and communists in the DSA, who are bent on not only wrecking the Democratic Party, but the country itself. While other Democrats in the U.S. Senate and the House have retreated, remain silent, or are seeking to accommodate the DSA and its radical proposals, Fetterman has stood alone on the national scene, defending the traditional values of the Democratic Party. For instance, Democrats like Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries have become openly obsequious in sucking up to the DSA. Schumer fears a 2028 challenge for re-election by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, supported by the New York City branch of the DSA. And Jeffries is afraid of being dumped as Democratic House leader by the rising tide of DSA congressional candidates. Velis, on a much smaller scale and with a much smaller megaphone, is trying to do the same thing as Fetterman. And like Fetterman, Velis has little or no support from fellow traditional Democrats who have caved in to DSA. While Fetterman has been too big to ignore nationally, the media in Massachusetts have generally paid little attention to Velis, perhaps because he has been ignored by Governor Maura Healey and the Democratic establishment. Nevertheless, Velis plunges on. Outlining his view in an interview, Velis enters fourth term as state senator, said, the DSA runs afoul of everything I hold dear as a Democrat. While the DSA says abolish borders and ICE, I say no, he said. And the DSA wants to defund the police and abolish prisons, I say no. And the DSA wants to abolish the Pentagon and the military, I say no. And the DSA wants to abolish the presidency, the Senate, and the U.S. Supreme Court, I say no. I want nothing to do with all of that. We need to stand up for the ideas that made this country great, he said. Asked if he feared repercussions from fellow Democrats in the Democratic-controlled state Senate, while progressive Senate President Karen Spilka rules with an iron fist and no one speaks out of turn, Phyllis said, I'm not going to be quiet. You either stand up for the courage of your convictions or you do not. In the traditional Democratic Party, just to save itself, it needs more stand-up politicians like Vellis. Doug?
Here's an article by Tim Dunn. ICE grabs vehicular homicide suspect. Bristol sheriff slammed. He cites state law. An illegal immigrant from Brazil with a lengthy criminal history and who has been released three times by Massachusetts officials has been arrested by federal immigration authorities in Taunton. ICE Boston tells the Herald that Heriton da Silva Heredes of Brazil was apprehended by agents in Taunton during targeted operations on August 6th. Heredes captured came over a week after he was released by the Bristol County Sheriff's Office, who also ignored an ICE detainer request for him as he faces vehicular homicide charges. That's just one of three times ICE says that local or state authorities in Massachusetts released Heredes in order to avoid apprehension by ICE. Sadly, it appeared as though Bristol County Sheriff Paul Heroux followed through on his promise to not cooperate with ICE, resulting in the release of this habitual criminal, illegal alien offender, who is currently charged with vehicular homicide, back into his constituent's community. In fact, on three separate occasions, this criminal, illegal alien, was in the custody of state or local authorities, and they released him without honoring our detainer. Acting ICE Enforcement and Removal Operations, or ERO, Boston Field Office Director Dave Wessling told the Herald. Had any of the prior detainers been honored, lives would have been saved. While sanctuary politicians signed performative legislation to protect habitual criminal offenders like Heredes, ERO Boston will continue to prioritize the law-abiding citizens. Bristol Sheriff Paul Heroux had launched a media blitz against ICE and DHS earlier this summer, telling several outlets that he will not honor ICE detainers because it's a violation of Massachusetts law. This is another example of how ICE Boston wants me to break state law, period. State law says that if someone posts bail, regardless of their immigration status or whether they are a citizen or not, we have to let that person go, period, full stop, Perro told the Herald over the phone yesterday. That is the Lund decision, which ICE knows about. We are not allowed to hold someone after they post bail. And what ICE is asking me to do is to break state law, and I'm not going to do that, he said.
Here's a disturbing report. The U.S. debt surpasses $40 trillion. Washington, from the Associated Press. The national debt surpassed a record $40 trillion. On Wednesday, a staggering milestone as defense costs, social programs like Social Security and Medicare, and the interest on the burgeoning deficit make up an enormous share of federal spending. The milestone figure was recorded just 5 months after the U.S. hit a record $39 trillion in March and reached $38 million 5 months before that, in October. The unprecedented $40 trillion figure highlights competing administration priorities, from boosting defense spending that the United States relies on to carry out President Donald Trump's almost six-month-old war in Iran, to lowering the cost of gas and groceries. Kush Desai, a White House spokesman, said the Trump administration has been focused on slashing waste, fraud, and abuse in federal spending while accelerating economic growth to get America's debt to GDP ratios trending in the right direction. However, experts say the exploding debt and the latest record milestone are already affecting American pocketbooks by raising borrowing costs for things like mortgages and cars, lowering wages from businesses that have to pay money available to invest, and creating more expensive goods and services. If we want to improve our living standards today and for the next generation, now is the time for lawmakers to put our nation on a more affordable and sustainable path, said Michael A. Peterson, CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, a think tank focused on U.S. fiscal challenges. The debt has exploded over several presidential administrations as the nation's leading spending leaders spend more money than it collects in taxes. In recent memory, the multi-year COVID-19 pandemic shut down much of the U.S. economy, where the federal government borrowed heavily during President Trump's first term and under former President Joe Biden to stabilize the economy and support a recovery. More government spending was approved after Trump signed the Republicans' tax and spending legislation into law last year. Advocates for a balanced budget also warn that the long-term trend of borrowing more and paying more in interest will force Americans to face tougher fiscal trade-offs ahead. Federal debt is already raising the cost of living and choking out other spending and investment, threatening our economy and America's long-term prosperity, said Margaret Spelling, president and CEO of the Bipartisan Policy Center. Our current fiscal trajectory is plainly unsustainable, and that's the best-case scenario. AI disruption, a recession, global war, or any number of other events could quickly push us over the edge from a challenge into a full-blown crisis. Doug?
Turning to sports in the Boston Red Sox, this is Max Cerullo's article. Tracy lays out a plan for Anthony over coming days. After enjoying a perfect night at the plate in his long-awaited return to the field, Roman Anthony got a night off. Anthony did not play Wednesday in Portland, and Red Sox interim manager Chad Tracy said the plan is for the 22-year-old to play back-to-back games on Thursday and Friday before deciding how to proceed from there. Tracy said Anthony will play left field on Thursday and serve as the DH on Friday, and added that Anthony came out of Tuesday's first rehab game feeling good, and that the decision to have him sit Wednesday was made well in advance. "We left it a hybrid day just because it was going to be his first day," Tracy said. "So it was our decision. Let's be off today with the intent of playing back-to-back the next two." Anthony hasn't played in the big leagues since suffering a sprain in his right hand during the Red Sox game May 4th in Detroit. The outfielder's recovery has stretched on far longer than originally expected, but Anthony looked like his normal self Tuesday night in Portland. The highlight of the night was his tape measure two-run home run, which sailed all the way out of Hadlock Field and landed on the adjacent Fitzpatrick Stadium turf. Anthony also hit 108 mile an hour line drive the opposite way to left field and drew two walks. How much more time might he need Thursday and Friday? Tracy said the club will be taking day to day, but they don't plan to rush things. And that is all the time we have today. Thank you for listening.